nature, Pierre's journeys and occupations, the war and so on. The preoccupation and despondency which Pierre had noticed in his friend's look was now still more clearly expressed in the smile with which he listened to Pierre, especially when he spoke with joyful animation of the past or the future. It was as if Prince Andrei would have liked to sympathise with what Pierre was saying, but could not. The latter began to feel that it was in bad taste to speak of his enthusiasms, dreams, and hopes of happiness or goodness in Prince Andrei's presence. He was ashamed to express his new Masonic views, which had been particularly revived and strengthened by his late tour. He checked himself, fearing to seem naive, yet he felt an irresistible desire to show his friend as soon as possible that he was now a quite different and better Pierre than he had been in Petersburg. "I can't tell you how much I've lived through since then. I hardly know myself again." "Yes, we have altered much, very much, since then," said Prince Andrei.
"Well, and you? What are your plans?"
"Plans?" repeated Prince Andrei, ironically. "My plans," he said, as if astonished at the word. "Well, you see, I'm building. I mean to settle here altogether next year." Pierre looked silently and searchingly into Prince Andrei's face, which had grown much older.
"No, I meant to ask,"
Pierre began, but Prince Andrei interrupted him.
"But why talk of me? Talk to me, yes. Tell me about your travels and all you've been doing on your estates."
Pierre began describing what he had done on his estates, trying as far as possible to conceal his own part in the improvements that had been made. Prince Andrei several times prompted Pierre's story of what he had been doing, as though it were all an old-time story, and he listened not only without interest, but even as if ashamed of what Pierre was telling him. Pierre felt uncomfortable and even depressed in his friend's company, and at last became silent.
"I'll tell you what, my dear fellow," said Prince Andrei, who evidently also felt depressed and constrained with his visitor. "I am only bivouacking here and have just come to look round. I'm going back to my sister today. I will introduce you to her. But of course you know her already," he said, evidently trying to entertain a visitor with whom he now found nothing in common. "We will go after dinner. And would you now like to look around my place?"
They went out and walked about till dinner time, talking of the political news and common acquaintances, like people who do not know each other intimately. Prince Andrei spoke with some animation and interest only of the new homestead he was constructing and its buildings, but even here, while on the scaffolding, in the midst of a talk explaining the future arrangements of the house, he interrupted himself.
"However, this is not at all interesting. Let us have dinner, and then we'll set off."
At dinner, conversation turned on Pierre's marriage.
"I was very much surprised when I heard of it," said Prince Andrei.
Pierre blushed, as he always did when it was mentioned, and said hurriedly,
I will tell you sometime how it all happened, but you know it is all over and forever."
"Forever?" said Prince Andrei.
"Nothing's forever."
"But you know how it all ended, don't you? You heard of the duel."
"And so you had to go through that, too."
"One thing I thank God for is that I did not kill that man," said Pierre.
"Why so?" asked Prince Andrei. "To kill a vicious dog is a very good thing, really."
"No, to kill a man is bad, wrong."
"Why is it wrong?" urged Prince Andrei. "It is not given to man to know what is right and what is wrong. Men always did and always will err, and in nothing more than in what they consider right and wrong."
"What does harm to another is wrong,"
said Pierre, feeling with pleasure that for the first time since his arrival, Prince Andrei was roused, had begun to talk, and wanted to express what had brought him to his present state.
"And who has told you what is bad for another man?" he asked.
"Bad, bad," exclaimed Pierre. "We all know what is bad for ourselves."
"Yes, we know that. But the harm I am conscious of in myself is something I cannot inflict on others," said Prince Andrei, growing more and more animated, and evidently wishing to express his new outlook to Pierre. He spoke in French.
I only know two very real evils in life, remorse and illness. The only good is the absence of those evils. To live for myself, avoiding those two evils, is my whole philosophy now.
And love of one's neighbour? And self-sacrifice? Began Pierre.
No, I can't agree with you. To live only so as not to do evil, and not to have to repent, is not enough.
I lived like that. I lived for myself and ruined my life. And only now, when I am living, or at least trying, Pierre's modesty made him correct himself, to live for others, only now have I understood all the happiness of life. No, I shall not agree with you, and you do not really believe what you are saying.
Prince Andrei looked silently at Pierre with an ironic smile.
When you see my sister, Princess Maria, you'll get on with her, he said. Perhaps you are right for yourself, he added after a short pause, but everyone lives in his own way. You lived for yourself, and say you nearly ruined your life and only found happiness when you began living for others. I experienced just the reverse. I lived for glory. And after all, what is glory? The same love of others, a desire to do something for them, a desire for their approval. So I lived for others, and not almost, but quite ruined my life. And I have become calmer since I began to live only for myself.
But what do you mean by living only for yourself? Asked Pierre, growing excited. What about your son, your sister, and your father?
But that's just the same as myself. They are not others, explained Prince Andrei. The others, one's neighbours, le prochain, as you and Princess Maria call it, are the chief source of all error and evil. Le prochain, your Kiev peasants to whom you want to do good.
And he looked at Pierre with a mocking, challenging expression. He evidently wished to draw him on.
You are joking, replied Pierre, growing more and more excited. What error or evil can there be in my wishing to do good, and even doing a little, though I did very little and did it very badly? What evil can there be in it if unfortunate people, our serfs, people like ourselves, were growing up and dying with no idea of God and truth beyond ceremonies and meaningless prayers, and are now instructed in a comforting belief in future life, retribution, recompense and consolation? What evil and error are there in it if people were dying of disease without help, while material assistance could so easily be rendered, and I supplied them with a doctor, a hospital, and an asylum for the aged? And is it not a palpable, unquestionable good if a peasant or a woman with a baby has no rest day or night, and I give them rest and leisure? Said Pierre, hurrying and lisping. And I have done that, though badly and to a small extent, but I've done something towards it, and you cannot persuade me that it was not a good action. And more than that, you can't make me believe that you do not think so yourself. And the main thing is, he continued, that I know, and know for certain, that the enjoyment of doing this good is the only sure happiness in life.
Yes, if you put it like that, it's quite a different matter, said Prince Andrei. I build a house and lay out a garden, and you build hospitals. The one and the other may serve as a pastime, but what's right and what's good must be judged by one who knows all, but not by us. Well, you want an argument, he added. Come on, then.
They rose from the table and sat down in the entrance porch, which served as a veranda.
Come, let's argue, then, said Prince Andrei. You talk of schools, he went on, crooking a finger, education and so forth. That is, you want to raise him, pointing to a peasant who passed by them taking off his cap, from his animal condition and awaken in him spiritual needs, while it seems to me that animal happiness is the only happiness possible, and that is just what you want to deprive him of. I envy him, but you want to make him what I am, without giving him my means. Then you say, lighten his toil. But as I see it, physical labour is as essential to him, as much a condition of his existence, as mental activity is to you or me. You can't help thinking. I go to bed after 2 in the morning, thoughts come and I can't sleep, but toss about till dawn, because I think and can't help thinking, just as he can't help ploughing and mowing. If he didn't,
He would go to the drink shop or fall ill. Just as I could not stand his terrible physical labour but should die of it in a week, so he could not stand my physical idleness but would grow fat and die. The third thing, what else was it you talked about? And Prince Andrei crooked a third finger. Ah, yes, hospitals, medicine. He has a fit, he is dying, and you come and bleed him and patch him up. He will drag about as a cripple, a burden to everybody, for another 10 years. It would be far easier and simpler for him to die. Others are being born, and there are plenty of them as it is. It would be different if you grudged losing a labourer, that's how I regard him, but you want to cure him from love of him, and he does not want that. And besides, what a notion that medicine ever cured anyone. Killed them, yes, said he, frowning angrily and turning away from Pierre. Prince Andrei expressed his ideas so clearly and distinctly that it was evident he had reflected on this subject more than once, and he spoke readily and rapidly like a man who has not talked for a long time. His glance became more animated as his conclusions became more hopeless.
Oh, that is dreadful, dreadful, said Pierre. I don't understand how one can live with such ideas. I had such moments myself not long ago in Moscow and when travelling, but at such times I collapse so that I don't live at all. Everything seems hateful to me, myself most of all. Then I don't eat, don't wash, and how is it with you?
Why not wash? That is not cleanly, said Prince Andrei. On the contrary, one must try to make one's life as pleasant as possible. I'm alive. That is not my fault, so I must live out my life as best I can without hurting others.
But with such ideas, what motive have you for living? One would sit without moving, undertaking nothing.
Life as it is leaves one no peace. I should be thankful to do nothing. But here, on the one hand, the local nobility have done me the honour to choose me to be their marshal. It was all I could do to get out of it. They could not understand that I have not the necessary qualifications for it, the kind of good-natured, fussy shallowness necessary for the position. Then there's this house, which must be built in order to have a nook of one's own in which to be quiet. And now there's this recruiting.
Why aren't you serving in the army?
After Austerlitz, said Prince Andrei gloomily. No, thank you very much. I have promised myself not to serve again in the active Russian army, and I won't, not even if Bonaparte were here at Smolensk threatening Bald Hills. Even then I wouldn't serve in the Russian army. Well, as I was saying, he continued, recovering his composure, now there's this recruiting. My father is chief in command of the 3rd District, and my only way of avoiding active service is to serve under him.
Then you are serving?
I am. He paused a little while.
And why do you serve?
Why? For this reason. My father is one of the most remarkable men of his time, but he is growing old, and though not exactly cruel, he has too energetic a character. He is so accustomed to unlimited power that he is terrible. And now he has this authority of a commander-in-chief of the recruiting granted by the Emperor. If I had been 2 hours late a fortnight ago, he would have had a paymaster's clerk at Yukhnova hanged, said Prince Andrei with a smile. So I am serving because I alone have any influence with my father, and now and then can save him from actions which would torment him afterwards.
Well, there, you see?
Yes, but it's not as you imagine, Prince Andrei continued. I did not and do not in the least care about that scoundrel of a clerk who had stolen some boots from the recruits. I should even have been very glad to see him hanged. But I was sorry for my father. That, again, is for myself. Prince Andrei grew more and more animated. His eyes glittered feverishly while he tried to prove to Pierre that in his actions there was no desire to do good to his neighbour. There now. You wish to liberate your serfs, he continued. That is a very good thing, but not for you. I don't suppose you ever had anyone flogged or sent to Siberia, and still less for your serfs. If they are beaten, flogged, or sent to Siberia, I don't suppose they are any the worse off. In Siberia they lead the same animal life, and the stripes on their bodies heal, and they are happy as before.
But it is a good thing for proprietors who perish morally, bring remorse upon themselves, stifle this remorse and grow callous as a result of being able to inflict punishments justly and unjustly. It is those people I pity, and for their sake I should like to liberate the serfs. You may not have seen, but I have seen, how good men, brought up in those traditions of unlimited power, in time when they grow more irritable, become cruel and harsh, and are conscious of it, but cannot restrain themselves, and grow more and more miserable.
Prince Andrei spoke so earnestly that Pierre could not help thinking that these thoughts had been suggested to Prince Andrei by his father's case. He did not reply.
So, that's what I'm sorry for. Human dignity, peace of mind, purity, and not the serfs' backs and foreheads, which, beat and shave as you may, always remain the same backs and foreheads.
No, no, 1,000 times no. I shall never agree with you, said Pierre.
Chapter 12. Pierre and Prince Andrei talk on the ferry raft. In the evening, Andrei and Pierre got into the open carriage and drove to Bald Hills. Prince Andrei, glancing at Pierre, broke the silence now and then with remarks which showed that he was in a good temper. Pointing to the fields, he spoke of the improvements he was making in his husbandry. Pierre remained gloomily silent, answering in monosyllables and apparently immersed in his own thoughts. He was thinking that Prince Andrei was unhappy, had gone astray, did not see the true light, and that he, Pierre, ought to aid, enlighten, and raise him. But as soon as he thought of what he should say, he felt that Prince Andrei, with one word, one argument, would upset all his teaching, and he shrank from beginning, afraid of exposing to possible ridicule what to him was precious and sacred.
"No, but why do you think so?" Pierre suddenly began, lowering his head and looking like a bull about to charge. "Why do you think so? You should not think so."
"Think? What about?" asked Prince Andrei with surprise.
"About life, about man's destiny. It can't be so. I myself thought like that, and do you know what saved me? Freemasonry. No, don't smile. Freemasonry is not a religious ceremonial sect as I thought it was. Freemasonry is the best expression of the best, the eternal aspects of humanity."
And he began to explain Freemasonry as he understood it to Prince Andrei. He said that Freemasonry is the teaching of Christianity freed from the bonds of state and church, a teaching of equality, brotherhood, and love.
"Only our holy brotherhood has the real meaning of life. All the rest is a dream," said Pierre. "Understand, my dear fellow, that outside this union all is filled with deceit and falsehood, and I agree with you that nothing is left for an intelligent and good man but to live out his life like you, merely trying not to harm others. But make our fundamental convictions your own. Join our brotherhood. Give yourself up to us. Let yourself be guided, and you will at once feel yourself as I have felt myself, a part of that vast invisible chain, the beginning of which is hidden in heaven," said Pierre.
Prince Andrei, looking straight in front of him, listened in silence to Pierre's words. More than once, when the noise of the wheels prevented his catching what Pierre said, he asked him to repeat it, and by the peculiar glow that came into Prince Andrei's eyes and by his silence, Pierre saw that his words were not in vain, and that Prince Andrei would not interrupt him or laugh at what he said. They reached a river that had overflowed its banks, and which they had to cross by ferry. While the carriage and horses were being placed on it, they also stepped on the raft. Prince Andrei, leaning his arms on the raft railing, gazed silently at the flooding waters glittering in the setting sun.
"Well, what do you think about it?" Pierre asked. "Why are you silent?"
"What do I think about it? I am listening to you. It's all very well. You say, join our brotherhood, and we will show you the aim of life, the destiny of man, and the laws which govern the world. But who are we, men? How is it you know everything? Why do I alone not see what you see? You see a reign of goodness and truth on earth.
But I don't see it," Pierre interrupted him. "Do you believe in a future life?" he asked.
"A future life?" Prince Andrei repeated, but Pierre, giving him no time to reply, took the repetition for a denial, the more readily as he knew Prince Andrei's former atheistic convictions.
"You say you can't see a reign of goodness and truth on earth, nor could I, and it cannot be seen if one looks on our life here as the end of everything. On earth, here on this earth," Pierre pointed to the fields, "there is no truth. All is false and evil. But in the universe, in the whole universe, there is a kingdom of truth, and we who are now the children of earth are eternally children of the whole universe. Don't I feel in my soul that I am part of this vast harmonious whole? Don't I feel that I form one link, one step between the lower and higher beings in this vast harmonious multitude of beings in whom the deity, the supreme power, if you prefer the term, is manifest? If I see, clearly see, that ladder leading from plant to man, why should I suppose it breaks off at me and does not go farther and farther? I feel that I cannot vanish, since nothing vanishes in this world, but that I shall always exist and always have existed. I feel that beyond me and above me there are spirits, and that in this world there is truth."
"Yes, that is Herder's theory," said Prince Andrei. "But it is not that which can convince me, dear friend. Life and death are what convince. What convinces is when one sees a being dear to one, bound up with one's own life, before whom one was to blame and had hoped to make it right." Prince Andrei's voice trembled and he turned away. "And suddenly that being is seized with pain, suffers, and ceases to exist. Why? It cannot be that there is no answer. And I believe there is. That's what convinces. That's what has convinced me," said Prince Andrei.
"Yes, yes, of course," said Pierre. "Isn't that what I'm saying?"
"No. All I say is that it is not argument that convinces me of the necessity of a future life, but this. When you go hand in hand with someone, and all at once that person vanishes, there, into nowhere, and you yourself are left facing that abyss and look in, and I have looked in."
"Well, that's it then. You know that there is a there, and there is a someone. There is the future life. The someone is God."
Prince Andrei did not reply. The carriage and horses had long since been taken off onto the farther bank and re-harnessed. The sun had sunk half below the horizon, and an evening frost was starring the puddles near the ferry. But Pierre and Andrei, to the astonishment of the footmen, coachmen, and ferrymen, still stood on the raft and talked.
"If there is a God and future life, there is truth and good, and man's highest happiness consists in striving to attain them. We must live, we must love, and we must believe that we live not only today on this scrap of earth, but have lived and shall live forever, there, in the whole," said Pierre, and he pointed to the sky.
Prince Andrei stood leaning on the railing of the raft, listening to Pierre, and he gazed with his eyes fixed on the red reflection of the sun gleaming on the blue waters. There was perfect stillness. Pierre became silent. The raft had long since stopped, and only the waves of the current beat softly against it below. Prince Andrei felt as if the sound of the waves kept up a refrain to Pierre's words, whispering, "It is true, believe it." He sighed, and glanced with a radiant, childlike, tender look at Pierre's face, flushed and rapturous, yet shy before his superior friend.
"Yes, if only it were so," said Prince Andrei. "However, it is time to get on," he added, and stepping off the raft, he looked up at the sky, to which Pierre had pointed,
and for the first time since Austerlitz saw that high, everlasting sky he had seen while lying on that battlefield. And something that had long been slumbering, something that was best within him, suddenly awoke, joyful and youthful in his soul. It vanished as soon as he returned to the customary conditions of his life, but he knew that this feeling, which he did not know how to develop, existed within him. His meeting with Pierre formed an epoch in Prince Andrei's life. Though outwardly he continued to live in the same old way, inwardly he began a new life. Chapter 13. God's Folk at Bald Hills. It was getting dusk when Prince Andrei and Pierre drove up to the front entrance of the house at Bald Hills. As they approached the house, Prince Andrei, with a smile, drew Pierre's attention to a commotion going on at the back porch. A woman, bent with age, with a wallet on her back, and a short, long-haired young man in a black garment, had rushed back to the gate on seeing the carriage drive up. Two women ran out after them, and all four, looking round at the carriage, ran in dismay up the steps of the back porch. "Those are Maria's God's folk," said Prince Andrei. "They have mistaken us for my father. This is the one matter in which she disobeys him. He orders these pilgrims to be driven away, but she receives them."
"But what are God's folk?" asked Pierre.
Prince Andrei had no time to answer. The servants came out to meet them, and he asked where the old prince was and whether he was expected back soon. The old prince had gone to the town and was expected back any minute. Prince Andrei led Pierre to his own apartments, which were always kept in perfect order and readiness for him in his father's house. He himself went to the nursery. "Let us go and see my sister," he said to Pierre when he returned. "I have not found her yet. She is hiding now, sitting with her God's folk. It will serve her right. She will be confused, but you will see her God's folk. It's really very curious."
"What are God's folk?" asked Pierre.
"Come, and you'll see for yourself." Princess Maria really was disconcerted, and red patches came on her face when they went in. In her snug room, with lamps burning before the icon stand, a young lad with a long nose and long hair, wearing a monk's cassock, sat on the sofa beside her, behind a samovar. Near them, in an armchair, sat a thin, shrivelled old woman, with a meek expression on her childlike face.
"Andrei, why didn't you warn me?" said the princess with mild reproach,
as she stood before her pilgrims like a hen before her chickens.
"Charmé de vous voir, delighted to see you," she said to Pierre as he kissed her hand.
She had known him as a child, and now his friendship with Andrei, his misfortune with his wife, and above all his kindly, simple face, disposed her favourably toward him. She looked at him with her beautiful, radiant eyes and seemed to say, "I like you very much, but please don't laugh at my people." After exchanging the first greetings, they sat down.
"Ah, and Ivanushka is here too," said Prince Andrei, glancing with a smile at the young pilgrim.
"Andrei," said Princess Maria imploringly.
"It's a girl, you know," said Prince Andrei to Pierre in French.
"Andrei, au nom de Dieu,"
Princess Maria repeated. It was evident that Prince Andrei's ironical tone towards the pilgrims and Princess Maria's helpless attempts to protect them were their customary long-established relations on the matter.
"But, my dear," said Prince Andrei in a low voice, "you ought, on the contrary, to be grateful to me for explaining to Pierre your intimacy with this young man."
"Really?" said Pierre, gazing over his spectacles with curiosity and seriousness, for which Princess Maria was specially grateful to him, into Ivanushka's face, who, seeing that she was being spoken about, looked round at them all with crafty eyes.
Princess Maria's embarrassment on her people's account was quite unnecessary. They were not in the least abashed. The old woman, lowering her eyes but casting side glances at the newcomers, had turned her cup upside down and placed a nibbled bit of sugar beside it, and sat quietly in her armchair, though hoping to be offered another cup of tea. Ivanushka, sipping out of her saucer, looked with sly, womanish eyes from under her brows at the young men.
"Where have you been?"
"To Kiev?" Prince Andrei asked the old woman.
"I have, good sir," she answered garrulously. "Just at Christmas time I was deemed worthy to partake of the holy and heavenly sacrament at the shrine of the saint, and now I'm from Kolyazin, master, where a great and wonderful blessing has been revealed."
"And was Ivanushka with you?"
"I go by myself, benefactor,"
said Ivanushka, trying to speak in a bass voice.
"I only came across Pelageya in Yukhovno."
Pelageya interrupted her companion. She evidently wished to tell what she had seen.
"In Kolyazin, master, a wonderful blessing has been revealed."
"What is it, some new relics?" asked Prince Andrei.
"Andrei, do leave off," said Princess Maria. "Don't tell him, Pelageya." "No, why not, my dear? Why shouldn't I? I like him. He is kind. He is one of God's chosen. He's a benefactor. He once gave me 10 rubles, I remember. When I was in Kiev, Crazy Cyril says to me, he's one of God's own and goes barefoot summer and winter, he says, 'Why are you not going to the right place? Go to Kolyazin, where a wonder-working icon of the Holy Mother of God has been revealed.' On hearing those words, I said goodbye to the holy folk and went."
All were silent. Only the pilgrim woman went on in measured tones, drawing in her breath.
"So I come, master, and the people say to me, 'A great blessing has been revealed. Holy oil trickles from the cheeks of our blessed mother, the Holy Virgin Mother of God.'"
"All right, all right. You can tell us afterwards," said Princess Maria, flushing.
"Let me ask her," said Pierre. "Did you see it yourselves?" he inquired. "Oh, yes, master, I was found worthy. Such a brightness on the face like the light of heaven, and from the Blessed Mother's cheek it drops and drops."
"But, dear me, that must be a fraud," said Pierre naively, who had listened attentively to the pilgrim.
"Oh, master, what are you saying?" exclaimed the horrified Pelageya, turning to Princess Maria for support.
"They impose on the people," he repeated.
"Lord Jesus Christ," exclaimed the pilgrim woman, crossing herself. "Oh, don't speak so, master. There was a general who did not believe and said the monks cheat, and as soon as he said it, he went blind. And he dreamed that the Holy Virgin Mother of the Kiev catacombs came to him and said, 'Believe in me and I will make you whole.' So he begged, 'Take me to her, take me to her. It's the real truth, I'm telling you. I saw it myself.' And so he was brought quite blind straight to her, and he goes up to her and he falls down and he says, 'Make me whole,' says he, 'and I'll give thee what the Tsar bestowed on me. I saw it myself, master. The star is fixed into the icon.' Well, and what do you think? He received his sight. 'It's a sin to speak so. God will punish you,'" she said admonishingly, turning to Pierre.
"How did the star get into the icon?" Pierre asked.
"And was the Holy Mother promoted to the rank of general?"
said Prince Andrei with a smile. Pelageya suddenly grew quite pale and clasped her hands.
"Oh, master, master, what a sin! And you who have a son," she began, her pallor suddenly turning to a vivid red. "Master, what have you said? God forgive you!" And she crossed herself. "Lord, forgive him! My dear, what does it mean?"
she asked, turning to Princess Maria. She got up and, almost crying, began to arrange her wallet. She evidently felt frightened and ashamed to have accepted charity in a house where such things could be said, and was at the same time sorry to have now to forego the charity of this house.
"Now, why need you do it?" said Princess Maria. "Why did you come to me?" "Come, Pelageya, I was joking," said Pierre. "Princesse, ma parole, je n'ai pas voulu l'offenser." "I did not mean anything, I was only joking," he said, smiling shyly and trying to efface his offence. "It was all my fault, and Andrei was only joking."
Pelageya stopped doubtfully. but in Pierre's face there was such a look of sincere penitence, and Prince Andrei glanced so meekly now at her and now at Pierre, that she was gradually reassured.
Chapter 14. Old Prince Bolkonski and Pierre. The pilgrim woman was appeased, and being encouraged to talk, gave a long account of Father Amphilochus, who led so holy a life that his hands smelt of incense, and how on her last visit to Kiev some monks she knew let her have the keys of the catacombs, and how she, taking some dried bread with her, had spent 2 days in the catacombs with the saints.
"I'd pray a while to one, ponder a while, then go on to another. I'd sleep a bit and then again go and kiss the relics, and there was such peace all around, such blessedness, that one don't want to come out, even into the light of heaven again."
Pierre listened to her attentively and seriously. Prince Andrei went out of the room, and then, leaving God's folk to finish their tea, Princess Maria took Pierre into the drawing-room.
"You are very kind," she said to him.
"Oh, I really did not mean to hurt her feelings. I understand them so well and have the greatest respect for them." Princess Maria looked at him silently and smiled affectionately.
"I have known you a long time, you see, and I'm as fond of you as of a brother," she said. "How do you find Andrei?" she added hurriedly, not giving him time to reply to her affectionate words. "I am very anxious about him. His health was better in the winter, but last spring his wound reopened, and the doctor said he ought to go away for a cure. And I am also very much afraid for him spiritually. He has not a character like us women, who, when we suffer, can weep away our sorrows. He keeps it all within him. Today he is cheerful and in good spirits, but that is the effect of your visit. He is not often like that. If you could persuade him to go abroad, he needs activity, and this quiet, regular life is very bad for him. Others don't notice it, but I see it."
Toward 10 o'clock, the men servants rushed to the front door, hearing the bells of the old prince's carriage approaching. Prince Andrei and Pierre also went out into the porch.
"Who's that?"
asked the old prince, noticing Pierre as he got out of the carriage.
"Ah, very glad. Kiss me,"
he said, having learned who the young stranger was. The old prince was in a good temper and very gracious to Pierre. Before supper, Prince Andrei, coming back to his father's study, found him disputing hotly with his visitor. Pierre was maintaining that a time would come when there would be no more wars. The old prince disputed it chaffingly, but without getting angry.
"Drain the blood from men's veins and put in water instead, and then there'll be no more wars. Old women's nonsense, old women's nonsense," he repeated, but still he patted Pierre affectionately on the shoulder, and then went up to the table where Prince Andrei, evidently not wishing to join in the conversation, was looking over the papers his father had brought from town. The old prince went up to him and began to talk business. "The marshal, Count Rostov, hasn't sent half his contingent. He came to town and wanted to invite me to dinner. I gave him a pretty dinner. And there, look at this. Well, my boy," the old prince went on, addressing his son and patting Pierre on the shoulder, "a fine fellow, your friend. I like him. He stirs me up. Another says clever things and one doesn't care to listen, but this one talks rubbish yet stirs an old fellow up. Well, go, get along. Perhaps I'll come and sit with you at supper. We'll have another dispute. Make friends with my little fool, Princess Maria," he shouted after Pierre through the door.
Only now, on his visit to Bald Hills, did Pierre fully realise the strength and charm of his friendship with Prince Andrei. That charm was not expressed so much in his relations with him as with all his family and with the household, with the stern old prince and the gentle, timid Princess Maria. Though he had scarcely known them, Pierre at once felt like an old friend. They were all fond of him already. Not only Princess Maria, who had been won by his gentleness with the pilgrims, gave him her most radiant looks, but even the one-year-old Prince Nikolai, as his grandfather called him, smiled at Pierre and let himself be taken in his arms, and Mikhail Ivanovich and Mademoiselle Bourienne looked at him with pleasant smiles when he talked to the old prince. The old prince came in to supper.
This was evidently on Pierre's account, and during the 2 days of the young man's visit, he was extremely kind to him and told him to visit them again. When Pierre had gone and the members of the household met together, they began to express their opinions of him, as people always do after a new acquaintance has left. But as seldom happens, no one said anything but what was good of him. Chapter 15. Nikolai rejoins his regiment. When returning from his leave, Rostov felt for the first time how close was the bond that united him to Denisov and the whole regiment. On approaching it, Rostov felt as he had done when approaching his home in Moscow. When he saw the first hussar with the unbuttoned uniform of his regiment, when he recognized red-haired Dementiev and saw the picket ropes of the roan horses, when Lavrushka gleefully shouted to his master, "The Count has come!" and Denisov, who had been asleep on his bed, ran all dishevelled out of the mud hut to embrace him, and the officers collected round to greet the new arrival, Rostov experienced the same feeling as when his mother, his father, and his sister had embraced him, and tears of joy choked him so that he could not speak. The regiment was also a home, and as unalterably dear and precious as his parents' house. When he had reported himself to the commander of the regiment and had been reassigned to his former squadron, had been on duty and had gone out foraging, when he had again entered into all the little interests of the regiment and felt himself deprived of liberty and bound in one narrow, unchanging frame, he experienced the same sense of peace, of moral support, and the same sense of being at home here in his own place as he had felt under the parental roof. But here was none of all that turmoil of the world at large, where he did not know his right place and took mistaken decisions. Here was no Sonya with whom he ought or ought not to have an explanation. Here was no possibility of going there or not going there. Here there were not 24 hours in the day which could be spent in such a variety of ways. There was not that innumerable crowd of people of whom not one was nearer to him or farther from him than another. There were none of those uncertain and undefined money relations with his father, and nothing to recall that terrible loss to Dolokhov. Here, in the regiment, all was clear and simple. The whole world was divided into two unequal parts. One, our Pavlograd regiment, the other, all the rest. And the rest was no concern of his. In the regiment, everything was definite. Who was lieutenant, who captain, who was a good fellow, who a bad one, and most of all, who was a comrade. The canteen keeper gave one credit, one's pay came every 4 months. There was nothing to think out or decide. You had only to do nothing that was considered bad in the Pavlograd regiment, and when given an order, to do what was clearly, distinctly, and definitely ordered, and all would be well. Having once more entered into the definite conditions of this regimental life, Rostov felt the joy and relief a tired man feels on lying down to rest. Life in the regiment during this campaign was all the pleasanter for him, because after his loss to Dolokhov, for which, in spite of all his family's efforts to console him, he could not forgive himself, he had made up his mind to atone for his fault by serving, not as he had done before, but really well, and by being a perfectly first-rate comrade and officer. In a word, a splendid man altogether, a thing which seemed so difficult out in the world, but so possible in the regiment. After his losses, he had determined to pay back his debt to his parents in 5 years. He received 10,000 rubles a year, but now resolved to take only 2,000 and leave the rest to repay the debt to his parents. Our army, after repeated retreats and advances, and battles at Pultusk and Preussisch Eylau, was concentrated near Bartenstein. It was awaiting the Emperor's arrival and the beginning of a new campaign. The Pavlograd regiment, belonging to that part of the army which had served in the 1805 campaign, had been recruiting up to strength in Russia, and arrived too late to take part in the first actions of the campaign. It had been neither at Pultusk nor at Preussisch Eylau, and when it joined the army in the field in the second half of the campaign, was attached to Platov's division.
Platov's division was acting independently of the main army. Several times parts of the Pavlograd regiment had exchanged shots with the enemy, had taken prisoners, and once had even captured Marshal Udino's carriages. In April, the Pavlograds were stationed immovably for some weeks near a totally ruined and deserted German village. A thaw had set in. It was muddy and cold. The ice on the river broke, and the roads became impassable. For days, neither provisions for the men nor fodder for the horses had been issued. As no transports could arrive, the men dispersed about the abandoned and deserted villages searching for potatoes, but found few even of these. Everything had been eaten up, and the inhabitants had all fled. If any remained, they were worse than beggars, and nothing more could be taken from them. Even the soldiers, usually pitiless enough, instead of taking anything from them, often gave them the last of their rations. The Pavlograd regiment had had only 2 men wounded in action, but had lost nearly half its men from hunger and sickness. In the hospitals, death was so certain that soldiers suffering from fever or the swelling that came from bad food preferred to remain on duty, and hardly able to drag their legs went to the front rather than to the hospitals. When spring came on, the soldiers found a plant just showing out of the ground that looked like asparagus, which for some reason they called Mashka's sweet root. It was very bitter, but they wandered about the fields seeking it and dug it out with their sabres and ate it, though they were ordered not to do so, as it was a noxious plant. That spring a new disease broke out among the soldiers, a swelling of the arms, legs and face, which the doctors attributed to eating this root. But in spite of all this, the soldiers of Denisov's squadron fed chiefly on Mashka's sweet root, because it was the second week that the last of the biscuits were being doled out at the rate of 0.5 pound a man, and the last potatoes received had sprouted and frozen. The horses also had been fed for a fortnight on straw from the thatched roofs, and had become terribly thin, though still covered with tufts of felty winter hair. Despite this destitution, the soldiers and officers went on living just as usual. Despite their pale, swollen faces and tattered uniforms, the hussars formed line for roll call, kept things in order, groomed their horses, polished their arms, brought in straw from the thatched roofs in place of fodder, and sat down to dine round the cauldrons, from which they rose up hungry, joking about their nasty food and their hunger. As usual in their spare time, they lit bonfires, steamed themselves before them naked, smoked, picked out and baked sprouting rotten potatoes, told and listened to stories of Potemkin's and Suvorov's campaigns, or to legends of Alyosha the Sly or the priest's labourer Mikolka. The officers, as usual, lived in twos and threes in the roofless, half-ruined houses. The seniors tried to collect straw and potatoes, and in general food for the men. The younger ones occupied themselves as before, some playing cards, there was plenty of money, though there was no food, some with more innocent games, such as quoits and skittles. The general trend of the campaign was rarely spoken of, partly because nothing certain was known about it, partly because there was a vague feeling that in the main it was going badly. Rostov lived as before with Denisov, and since their furlough they had become more friendly than ever. Denisov never spoke of Rostov's family, but by the tender friendship his commander showed him, Rostov felt that the elder hussar's luckless love for Natasha played a part in strengthening their friendship. Denisov evidently tried to expose Rostov to danger as seldom as possible, and after an action greeted his safe return with evident joy. On one of his foraging expeditions, in a deserted and ruined village to which he had come in search of provisions, Rostov found a family consisting of an old Pole and his daughter with an infant in arms. They were half-clad, hungry, too weak to get away on foot, and had no means of obtaining a conveyance. Rostov brought them to his quarters, placed them in his own lodging, and kept them for some weeks while the old man was recovering. One of his comrades, talking of women, began chaffing Rostov, saying that he was more wily than any of them, and that it would not be a bad thing if he introduced them to the pretty Polish girl he had saved.
Rostov took the joke as an insult, flared up, and said such unpleasant things to the officer that it was all Denisov could do to prevent a duel. When the officer had gone away, Denisov, who did not himself know what Rostov's relations with the Polish girl might be, began to upbraid him for his quickness of temper, and Rostov replied, "Say what you like. She is like a sister to me, and I can't tell you how it offended me, because, well, for that reason." Denisov patted him on the shoulder and began rapidly pacing the room without looking at Rostov, as was his way at moments of deep feeling.
"Ah, what a mad breed you Rostovs are," he muttered, and Rostov noticed tears in his eyes.
Chapter 16. In April, the troops were enlivened by news of the Emperor's arrival, but Rostov had no chance of being present at the review he held at Bartenstein, as the Pavlograds were at the outposts far beyond that place. They were bivouacking. Denisov and Rostov were living in an earth hut, dug out for them by the soldiers, and roofed with branches and turf. The hut was made in the following manner, which had then come into vogue. A trench was dug, 3.5 feet wide, 4 feet 8 inches deep, and 8 feet long. At one end of the trench, steps were cut out, and these formed the entrance and the vestibule. The trench itself was the room, in which the lucky ones, such as the squadron commander, had a board lying on piles at the end opposite the entrance to serve as a table. On each side of the trench, the earth was cut out to a breadth of about 2.5 feet, and this did duty for bedsteads and couches. The roof was so constructed that one could stand up in the middle of the trench and could even sit up on the beds if one drew close to the table. Denisov, who was living luxuriously because the soldiers of his squadron liked him, had also a board in the roof at the farther end with a piece of broken but mended glass in it for a window. When it was very cold, embers from the soldiers' campfire were placed on a bench sheet of iron on the steps in the reception room, as Denisov called that part of the hut, and it was then so warm that the officers, of whom there were always some with Denisov and Rostov, sat in their shirt sleeves. In April, Rostov was on orderly duty. One morning, between 7 and 8, returning after a sleepless night, he sent for embers, changed his rain-soaked underclothes, said his prayers, drank tea, got warm, then tidied up the things on the table and in his own corner, and his face glowing from exposure to the wind and with nothing on but his shirt, lay down on his back, putting his arms under his head. He was pleasantly considering the probability of being promoted in a few days for his last reconnoitring expedition, and was awaiting Denisov, who had gone out somewhere and with whom he wanted to talk. Suddenly he heard Denisov shouting in a vibrating voice behind the hut, evidently much excited. Rostov moved to the window to see whom he was speaking to, and saw the quartermaster, Topchenko.
"I ordered you not to let them eat that Mashka woot stuff," Denisov was shouting, "and I saw with my own eyes how Lazarchuk brought some from the fields." "I have given the order again and again, Your Honour, but they don't obey," answered the quartermaster.
Rostov lay down again on his bed and thought complacently, "Let him fuss and bustle now. My job's done and I'm lying down capitally." He could hear that Lavrushka, that sly, bold orderly of Denisov's, was talking as well as the quartermaster. Lavrushka was saying something about loaded wagons, biscuits and oxen he had seen when he had gone out for provisions. Then Denisov's voice was heard shouting farther and farther away,
"Saddle! Second platoon!"
Where are they off to now? Thought Rostov. 5 minutes later, Denisov came into the hut, climbed with muddy boots on the bed, lit his pipe, furiously scattered his things about, took his leaded whip, buckled on his sabre, and went out again. In answer to Rostov's inquiry where he was going, he answered vaguely and crossly that he had some business.
"Let God and our great monarch judge me afterwards," said Denisov, going out,
and Rostov heard the hooves of several horses splashing through the mud. He did not even trouble to find out where Denisov had gone. Having got warm in his corner, he fell asleep and did not leave the hut till toward evening.
Denisov had not yet returned. The weather had cleared up, and near the next hut two officers and a cadet were playing Svaika, laughing as they threw their missiles, which buried themselves in the soft mud. Rostov joined them. In the middle of the game, the officers saw some wagons approaching with 15 hussars on their skinny horses behind them. The wagons, escorted by the hussars, drew up to the picket ropes, and a crowd of hussars surrounded them. "There now, Denisov has been worrying," said Rostov, "and here are the provisions." "So they are," said the officers. "Won't the soldiers be glad?" A little behind the hussars came Denisov, accompanied by two infantry officers with whom he was talking. Rostov went to meet them.
"I warn you, Captain," one of the officers, a short, thin man, evidently very angry, was saying. "Haven't I told you I won't give them up?" replied Denisov. "You will answer for it, Captain. It is mutiny, seizing the transport of one's own army. Our men have had nothing to eat for 2 days, and mine have had nothing for 2 weeks," said Denisov. "It's robbery. You'll answer for it, sir," said the infantry officer, raising his voice. "Now, what are you pestering me for?" cried Denisov, suddenly losing his temper. "I shall answer for it, not you, and you'd better not buzz about here till you get hurt. Be off! Go!" he shouted at the officers. "Very well, then," shouted the little officer, undaunted and not riding away. "If you're determined to rob, I'll—" "Go to the devil! Quick march while you're safe and sound!" And Denisov turned his horse on the officer. "Very well, very well," muttered the officer threateningly, and turning his horse he trotted away, jolting in his saddle. "A dog astride a fence! A wheeled dog astride a fence!" shouted Denisov after him, the most insulting expression a cavalryman can address to a mounted infantryman, and riding up to Rostov, he burst out laughing. "I've taken transports from the infantry by force," he said. "After all, can't let our men starve." The wagons that had reached the hussars had been consigned to an infantry regiment, but learning from Lavrushka that the transport was unescorted, Denisov, with his hussars, had seized it by force. The soldiers had biscuits dealt out to them freely, and they even shared them with the other squadrons. The next day, the regimental commander sent for Denisov, and holding his fingers spread out before his eyes, said, "This is how I look at this affair. I know nothing about it and won't begin proceedings, but I advise you to ride over to the staff and settle the business there in the commissariat department, and if possible, sign a receipt for such and such stores received. If not, as the demand was booked against an infantry regiment, there will be a row, and the affair may end badly." From the regimental commanders, Denisov rode straight to the staff with a sincere desire to act on this advice. In the evening, he came back to his dugout in a state such as Rostov had never yet seen him in. Denisov could not speak and gasped for breath. When Rostov asked what was the matter, he only uttered some incoherent oaths and threats in a hoarse, feeble voice. Alarmed at Denisov's condition, Rostov suggested that he should undress, drink some water, and send for a doctor. "Try me for robbery. Oh, some more water. Let them try me, but I'll always thrash scoundrels, and I'll tell the Emperor. Ice," he muttered.
The regimental doctor, when he came, said it was absolutely necessary to bleed Denisov. A deep saucer of black blood was taken from his hairy arm, and only then was he able to relate what had happened to him.
"I get there," began Denisov. "Now then, where's your chief's quarters?" They were pointed out. "Please to wait. I've ridden 20 miles and have duties to attend to, and no time to wait. Announce me." "Very well." So out comes their head chief. Also took it into his head to lecture me. "It's robbery. Robbery, I say, is not done by a man who seizes provisions to feed his soldiers, but by him who takes them to fill his own pockets. Will you please be silent?" "Very good." Then he says, "Go and give a receipt to the commissioner, but your affair will be passed on to headquarters." I go to the commissioner. I enter, and at a table, who do you think? No, but wait a bit. Who is it that's starving us?
shouted Denisov, hitting the table with his fist of his newly bled arm, so violently that the table nearly broke down and the tumblers on it jumped about.
Telyanin! What? So it's you who's starving us to death, is it? Take this and this! And I hit him so pat, straight on his snout. Oh, what a! And I started thwashing him. Well, I've had a bit of fun, I can tell you, cried Denisov, gleeful and yet angry, his white teeth showing under his black moustache. I'd have killed him if they hadn't taken him away.
But what are you shouting for? Calm yourself, said Rostov. You've set your arm bleeding afresh. Wait, we must tie it up again.